Hey, I'm Jonathan Carzel, and I'm here talking with Alistair Begg. We're talking about ministry, evangelism, and sharing Jesus as we go about our daily life. One of the things I've enjoyed about your ministry, your preaching ministry, but also personally, you have a keen evangelistic heart. Was that modeled to you? Did you see that through, say, Derek Prime? Was that modeled to you? Where did that come from?
You know, I haven't really thought about that. I think it's come from everywhere. It's come from the fact that I was brought up in Glasgow in an interdenominational mission hall,
yeah,
which had been founded as a result of the evangelistic missions of Moody, okay, and Sankey. And so in that environment, the combination of, you know, good news and good deeds was being worked out in the city center. Yeah. And I mean, I just thought, well, I guess that's what you do. You know, the people are poor and are in need of food and clothing and help. But more than that, they're in need of Jesus. And so that was there. As I went on in life, when, you know, the coffee bar scene was there in Yorkshire in the 60s, the reason that we would want to do that is so we could tell other people about Jesus. It never occurred to me that that would not be the end game.
Yeah.
So there's some say, well, what are you doing? You're just singing songs. Well, no, we're singing songs with a purpose. What's the purpose? To see people come to know Jesus. And then, of course, the influence of Campus Crusade, when I was 16, 17, and those fellows were, you know, very direct in the way they approach things. And my first reaction to that was somewhat negative until I really figured it out. And then I said, no, these people are very helpful because we can spend a lot of time just rambling and going on and on like I'm doing right now. And then sometimes you can cut to the chase. Mm. And I just love the way the Gospels and the disciples, you know, move very directly.
Have over the years with your preaching, have you intentionally changed or adapted the way you present the gospel, or has it, you know, you've always done it this way? And
I think I've always done it the same way. Hopefully I've done it a wee bit better as time has gone by, but I think I guess I've seen it done well. I mean, for example, David Watson, the late David Watson, who was in York, was masterful at those evangelistic addresses. Mm. Dick Lucas of St. Helens Bishopsgate with the business population, with, you know, establishing a framework of 22 minutes max.
Yeah.
And the constraint producing, you know, just pure gold. Mm. And I've always admired that, you know, the clarity along with brevity that doesn't need to go on and on and on. Mm. And so, you know, it's one thing observing it and trying to do it. It's another thing doing it. I mean, it's a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, it is. And I was going to ask you on a personal level, you know, as I was coming here today, I prayed before that I'd be able to speak to the Uber driver. Turned out he didn't speak English, so it didn't go well. But, you know, my heart began to race. You begin to, how will it go? Maybe a little nervousness. What advice would you give for somebody that is, they just find it difficult, or it does, it makes their mouth dry and their palms sweaty?
Yeah. Well, you know, venture.
Just try it. Just get on with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, the way that it will come is that you've created a context where the question comes to you. So, for example, the Uber driver. If the Uber driver says, so where am I taking you? You say, oh, I'm going to such and such a place. If you don't want to get into it, you just tell him he's going to the hotel.
Yeah.
If you say, well, I'm going to an event, I'm going to speak. I don't tell him what I'm going to speak on in the hope that he says what you're going to speak on. Now you've got an opportunity either to end the conversation by saying something, you know, sort of, well, I'm going to give a theological address. Or you can really advance the ball by saying, well, I'm just going there to speak about Jesus.
Yeah.
Now, that may end it as well. But if the guy goes, well, why would you want to do that? Now you're off to the races. Mm. Because he's the guy who's steering the conversation. Mm. And the same on the plane. If you've got your Bible Now, and I'm very wary of that as well. I don't want to look like, oh, look, you know.
Your big letter.
Yeah, you have a huge big Bible, you know. People moving away from it. looking for an open seat, putting their earphones on and say, oh, Lord, here we go. But, yeah, I mean, we want to approach things in a way that is humble, it's genuine, it's not formulaic. Mm. But I must say that anytime I get a little grasp of what my line is,
yes.
So for example, you know, how would you explain things? So with the good, the bad, the new, the perfect.
Yes.
So just that in my mind.
Have that framework
in my mind so I know. So well, did you see what happened with the plane crash that went down?
Mm.
Well, how in the world is this?
Mm.
Well, it's just a devastating thing, isn't it? The person will usually volunteer their view of the world.
Yep.
Then we got an opportunity to say, well. And then most recently, the fellow in Australia that I came across has just done this little evangelistic booklet where he says, you know, God made it, we broke it, Jesus fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that, and most people don't have any framework in their mind. So it's understandable that they're afraid to launch into the conversation because they've got no fixed points.
Yeah.
They've got nothing to bring it back to.
Yeah,
and that was always what you were taught in, you know, personal evangelism. Don't allow the person to drag you off into a discussion about the Sphinx in Egypt. Say to them, well, that's a good question, and we can come to that, but let me.
Yeah.
And so you control the conversation in that way. Otherwise, it goes pear-shaped real fast.
Well, a few things you've said there. One is preparation. So knowing the gospel for yourself,
right.
Having that framework, whether it's kind of through the Roman Road outline or Two Ways to Live or the ones you've said there. But then intention as well. Like, I'm going to seek to have a conversation. Because, with that Uber driver, you can quickly shut it down if you don't want to have a chat.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
But you also picked up on something that I think does change the conversation is when they ask a question.
Right.
Have you thought about how, because in the conversations Jesus has with people in the Gospels, questions either that he asks or that they ask really change the conversation. In your conversations, have you thought how you can draw out those questions, how they can, or questions that you ask that you know will bring questions about?
Yeah. I think the foundational question I was talking with is just in the last couple of days, and this person came to me saying that he has a Buddhist friend and he's done the cosmological argument with him and he's done this and he's done that and he's done the next thing. And I listened to him for as long as I possibly could, and he said, you know, is there a key? I said, well, there is a key, and that is that you present Jesus to them. Tell them who Jesus is. Tell them what Jesus has done. Say to them, look, there's a ton of questions, philosophical questions, scientific questions, but here's the one question.
Yeah.
Is Jesus Christ the person he claimed to be?
Hmm.
Let's give ourselves to a consideration of that and then allow the person to be very open in their questioning or in their pushback. Don't become immediately defensive or take the high ground.
Yeah.
Because it all depends, again, as you know, whether we've got a one-shot conversation here or whether we're dealing with a colleague at work that we're just having a coffee with.
Yeah.
So we're not trying to close the deal every time.
Mm.
We're just trying to advance the ball up the field a little bit and be content with that.
Can I pick up on that specifically? Family can be very, very difficult to share the gospel with because, one, they see your own sinful life, don't
they? That's right,
But it's an ongoing relationship. It's often at Christmas, you're not meant to mention politics and religion and money, but you also want to share Christ. Have you any advice for people in that situation?
Well, again, I think you're hoping for somebody to leverage Jesus into the conversation, and you're hoping that it isn't you. That if someone says, so what happened when you went to that thing?
Mm.
And I may have thrown that to you.
Okay.
So that you can get the opportunity to really say what was going on at the thing.
Yeah.
And not in a manipulative way,
But again, it's planning and an intention again.
It is. Yeah. Well, in it, yeah. If you aim at nothing, you're sure to hit it.
Yeah. Your church situation, where you know you were pastoring a large congregation, how did you help the church think evangelistically as individuals, perhaps some of what you've said, but then also corporately as a church? Did you have a particular pattern for evangelism? Did you have a minister that was in charge of evangelism? What did you do at Parkside?
Well, you know, when I go back to the good old days in Scotland...
I thought you were going to say Yorkshire.
Yeah, no, no. Well, I'm coming to Yorkshire. Okay. I'll be in Yorkshire in a bit. But, you know, Charlotte Chapel in Edinburgh was a city centre church. And once a month, we had a guest service. Hmm. Everybody knew that in that evening service on that particular day, there was a peculiar opportunity to invite friends to come to church. Hmm. And in the week preceding that, we went door to door in the flats and apartments of Edinburgh, knocking on doors, say, I would like just to leave an invitation for our church. It's here in the center.
Yeah.
Not everything lends it to that. But I followed that pattern then in Hamilton and did the same thing. And sometimes we would do a series of, you know, 10 that would be printed on a card, so that everybody knew where they were, when they were, and what they were. And and again, that gave the member of the congregation something to actually present. Not just like, would you like to come to a talk? But you chose provocative titles, if you like. You understand this. When I came here to the States, then I think I spent more trying to mobilize the people themselves. I did a thing called friendulism, friends, relatives, associates, neighbors, and I don't know what S was, friend. It was only F-R-A-N. Yeah, that's enough.
I'm dyslexic. You can do it however you like. Yeah. It'll work for me.
I'm pretty close myself, to tell the truth, as I just proved. But, here's the thing, though. If people become like their minister. For good or for ill, and if there's no sense of sort of evangelistic zeal that is coming out of the pulpit on a regular basis, it's unlikely that there will be sort of a picked up evangelism explosion.
Yes,
in that context, so that they respond not only to the exhortation to be a part of it, but they respond actually by realizing what it is that we're doing when we do that. I mean, they're saying, well, he might do it in a small section of a long talk, but I can do a small section in an environment. And they learn, I think they learn by example.
If a minister is examining themselves and thinking, oh, well, yeah, I've a evangelistic gap there, what advice would you give to him to develop that? Because you're absolutely right. The congregation will, for good or bad, end up like their minister.
Yeah. Well, you know, models, again, that, like I mentioned, for example, when I was a teenager in school, as a Christian, when I went to that evening service in St. Michael the Belfry in York, and that David Watson guy did what he did, I said to myself, wow, I want to be able to do that. I want to learn how you do that. And so I could never do it as he did it.
Sure.
But you got to pick guys that you can at least get close to. There's no point in picking some genius who starts apologetically with the cosmos, you know. That's not going to be me or somebody who uses scientific arguments to get to the place. I can't do that because it wouldn't be me. But at a different level involved in, let's say, if your brain is wired to the arts and to music and to stuff like that, then go with what you've got. Yeah. Don't go and try, if you know about baseball, then use it. But If you don't know anything about baseball, which I don't, then don't try and use those illustrations because the people go, he didn't understand that.
This may be unfair and you may not like doing it, but how would you assess what you do? Is it story and illustration and quotes? Because you call to memory song lyrics and poems. What? How would you describe your own sort of way?
On a good day, it's a dog's breakfast. If I really thought about it and analyzed it afterwards, I probably would never preach again.
Mm.
Because when I actually sometimes hear what I just did, it doesn't endear me to myself.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean that in a sense of false modesty.
Sure.
I mean it absolutely honestly. At that, I go, oh, golly, maybe I'd try that again, but not just like that. Years ago, I was asked if I would go, Don Carson asked me if I'd go to Trinity Seminary when I was here in the early days. What do you want me to do? I want you to come and be part of the practical theology department. I said, Don, no. I said, I couldn't do that. He said, well, why couldn't you do it? I said, well, because I only have like one talk. I mean, once I did my talk, I went, I can't just have the same talk every day.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, you're just being self-deprecating. I said, no, I'm telling you the truth. And secondly, the reason I don't want to do it is because I want to play. I want to play. I don't want to coach. I want to play. I want to be on the field. And that sense of being on the field and that genuine fearfulness that comes with running out onto the field is all part of the deal.
Yeah.
You know, because eventually you're just up there, you and Jesus on your own with your notes. And most guys, and this will sound self-serving maybe, I don't mean it to, but most guys who do what they do naturally don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so they're not good people. Like Alec Ferguson was a great manager. He was just an average player.
Yeah, yeah.
But guys who are instinctive in what they do, or you could move to golf, take a guy like Severiano Ballesteros. He wouldn't have been a guy to teach golf on a range.
Yeah.
But he was able to do stuff and attempt stuff that nobody else ever should. And so there is a sense in which there is freedom in that as well, that we're not trying to meet a certain standard. We're trying to meet the standard of humility and integrity and honesty with the scriptures. But beyond that, I always tell my colleagues, be yourself and forget yourself.
Yeah.
And the forgetting of yourself is part and parcel of that process. Because if you're monitoring, if you can hear yourself preaching while you're preaching, it's not good.
Yeah. That balance of self-critical, improving, developing, learning from others, while also not spending too much time thinking about yourself.
Right.
How do you get that balance?
Well, I think balance is always hard, isn't it? Because you only get balance by trying to correct situations. That from being out of balance, we're trying to get back in line.
Yeah.
This is where colleagues come into play. This is where at least one good friend comes into play. This is when listening to the people that you know have your back comes into play.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about just soliciting. If you solicit things, people may seek to, encourage you when
puff
you don't
you
deserve
or
it.
Yeah.
Or pull the rug out from underneath your feet because they think it would be something you deserve, which of course it might be. I think it's like, how do you, they've always asked the same thing. You go on the road because you've got to do all the thing for these. And the people say, well, how do you balance the time with your family?
Yeah.
And what about time with your wife? Well, I don't know what you say, but I say some weeks I get it wrong and some weeks I get it right.
Yeah.
And the weeks that I get it wrong, I know I've got to try and get it back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true, both in terms of every aspect of preaching, volume, like Nancy down here. I ask her, am I getting that horrible tone in my voice?
Yeah.
I ask her, what about pace? Am I starting to go like a steam train or an electric train? All those things. But most of all, because homiletically, it's either, are you loud or quiet? Are you very fast or are you very slow?
Yeah.
Are you high or are you low? You can do all of that, but the real issue is tone. Tone. What is the tone that comes out of you? Does it come out as, hey, I know? Mm. Or worse, to come out, I don't know, and I don't know if anybody wants to hear. That element of it, and that element, if you stand up and do books, which you do masterfully well, in the first 30 seconds, everybody in the room is going, is this guy for real? That's all they're asking. And the same when you're preaching. Right. I mean, in that initial encounter, they're actually making very fast judgments. Yeah. They may prove to be wrong judgments overall, but they want to know that the person up there is not at himself.
Yeah, yeah. And that genuine reality, the grounded kind of real.
The Yorkshire.
Okay, yeah.
It is.
Not everyone has the privilege of being from Yorkshire. Yeah. So good friends. I know you'd say Sue, your wife, has definitely kind of helped with that. If somebody is in a ministry position and they're looking around and thinking, I think I've got a weak spot that I don't have close friends like that, would you give it? What advice would you give to them?
Well, keep looking. I'm sure there's somebody in the context. It might be an unusual person. It might be a doctor in your congregation who has a wonderful bedside manner, and you don't have that sense of empathetic dimension. He'd be a good guy to go to. Maybe a carpenter who's used to cutting things and at angles and moving directly, and you tend to be all over the map. This guy could help you. An engineer who's putting together a bridge and knows that the pieces have to join up, and he's been listening to you for a while, and he knows that your stuff is full of non sequiturs. You know, that you apparently got from A to C without going to B, but everybody else needed B to get to C. That kind of thing, I think, I remember, I don't like doing this. Some of our colleagues, they do this regularly. They prepare the material, sit with the pastoral team, let the pastoral team pick it apart and make suggestions, everything else. My ego
not
can't.
For you.
my ego can't. I don't know if it's my ego or I don't know what it is. I don't want to do that. Once I got picked apart, I would be such a basket case, I could never use it.
Yeah.
And so very seldom do I ask somebody to give me a critique because I'm too afraid of what it's going to be. But I remember I asked Dick Lucas, I said, Dick, you know, if I send you a couple of my tapes, would you do something? Well, very reluctantly, of course, Dick said, oh, send it to me. Send it to me. And eventually I got a reply. Dear Alistair, I listened to the tapes. Slow down, Dick.
Huh.
That was it.
Yeah.
He said, you're speaking too fast. That was all I got from him. But it was enough.
I just want to ask one final question as we finish about preaching and just trying to draw in a few things that you've said there. One thing I notice with a number of preachers these days is they seem to present the truth, but it seems to be a harsh truth.
Right.
And one of the things I've admired from you is a clarity on the truth, as you have said frequently, keeping the main thing, but a gentleness while also not watering down the truth. Can you help us think through how you've gone about that to ensure there is a softness, a warmth perhaps, while also holding true to the truth of the gospel?
Again, I think it comes back to the influences on our lives, that I've tried to get the best out of every fellow that I had contact with. James Graham from Gold Hill Baptist Church in the 70s. He was Roy Castle and Fiona's pastor. Mm-hmm. Scott, clever, but he had a winsomeness in his delivery that for a while I tried to even talk like him.
Okay.
Until my wife said, you're not Jim Graham. from a distance, although I heard him up close, Lloyd-Jones, who could be as direct as anybody, but I never got the impression that he was talking down, that he would say, you know, and you don't need to listen to the voice of a little man, you know. And because that's not the voice you're listening to, and actually believing that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just going down that line, and part of it is, you know, I said today in this thing I had to do for the grandparents' conference, you know, I'm convinced that children are given to us for our sanctification. More than that, but they have certainly been in my life that when your own children are not where you might long for them to be, that will either put a harshness in you or it'll put a softness in you. That it will soften you in relationship. So you're not going to play the card about, well, and some of you have got kids that are just, you know, that sort of thing. Because now, you got that. And also when you're aware of your own sinful propensities. You know, somebody asked in the Q&A 2 nights ago, I said, so what has been the biggest problem that you've faced, you know, in 42 years? I said, me. And they think you're being funny. But no, you're not being funny. Because it's your own sinful heart. It's your own pride. It's your own neglect of prayer. That's the issue. And when you actually, in your heart of hearts, believe that, like, you know, the old stuff, that what you are in your bedroom, on your own, before God, is what you are and nothing else. When that really dawns and stays with you, then I think that is a contributing factor to a genuine winsomeness, a winsomeness, and the use of humor as well. We can talk about humor, but...
All right, well, let me pick you up on humor, because you use humor in your preaching.
Right.
Is there a place for humor in preaching and ministry?
I think so, for sure. I think there is. Not telling jokes. I would distinguish between, hey, did you hear the one about the rabbi and the priest? You know, that kind of stuff. And also, humor ought not to be used unless you're humorous. I mean, sort of like trying to be funny.
How do you know?
Well, I think you know by testing it, really.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That if you said something like, you know, whatever it might be, and the people said, I never thought about it like that before. The ironies, again, of both... They're not necessarily funny all the time, but, you know, for example, the disciples, right? I mean, they are rich in humor.
Yeah.
Right. He who has seen me has seen the Father. Philip says, show us the Father and that will suffice us. He said, Philip, were you in the room or what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know, the disciples, Jesus... And the disciple said, hey, get back with the kids. Jesus is doing evangelism.
Yeah.
And then the disciple turns around and says, pardon? He said, oh, yeah, no, bring him. Like, that's funny.
Yeah.
Or they come back from the evangelistic campaign.
Yeah.
And they say, it didn't go too well. Shall we call down fire from heaven? Jesus said, no, not right now, I don't think.
Yeah.
So... I just see things funny.
Yeah.
And so, but so did Spurgeon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Spurgeon was hilarious. In fact, he could shut the place down with humor. And they criticized him. And he said, if you knew how much I held in, you would compliment me.
Yeah.
So, you know, interestingly, Alec Mattia, unlikely guy in this respect, he told me that sometimes... when he was in the midst of something and he felt that the pressure was building up in the room, he would, for no other reason than that, introduce some humorous element in order to allow the congregation to breathe. Because it was like building up. He's going to let the steam off.
Interesting. Warren Wiersbe says of humor that it can be a lubricant that removes the tension. And it's similar
That's it. That's good.
He also said, and I found this helpful on a lot of occasions, that in ministry, there may be room for wit, but rarely comedy. Right. And I think that is helpful of the difference between the two.
Yeah.
This isn't just jokes.
Yeah, no, that's right.
But it can be something that...
Yeah. But I mean, it's a humorous picture, the angel at the gate, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if it wasn't humorous, it probably wouldn't have stuck quite the way that it did.
Yeah.
So we've just gone full circle.
You've been listening to me, Jonathan Castle, talking with Alistair Begg from Truth for Life. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation. You can find out more at truthforlife.org.